History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we know they don't have to go untold. If there are enough of us willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and to invest some time in patiently listening as memories from years ago return to the surface in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by what our veterans did way back when, and sometimes what they're still up to now. I have a feeling that's going to be the case today because the veteran we're going to meet definitely had that inspirational effect on me. You'll hear some of what he experienced in uniform, how he's making a difference for hurting veterans and their families today, and even the life-changing privilege he had of helping his World War II Marine father in a very unique and special way. I met Bob Wynn of Monterey, California, when I had the privilege of speaking to a great group of retirees in Aptos, California, at the monthly meeting of SIRS Branch 104. And I know you're going to enjoy getting to know this decorated Marine Corps veteran, too. I've had a lot of Marines tell me over the years, once a Marine, always a Marine, but it sounds like you were a Marine before you were even born. Explain that to me.
Well, my father was was a career Marine. He served 27 years in. He dropped out of college in 1941 during World War II, and he retired in 1967. He was an infantry officer, and I'm an only child, and my mother says that the first words I ever learned were the Marine Corps hymn. So I can't verify that, but that was the way the story went.
And your father's father was a Marine as well, right?
He was. He used to joke about it. I think he was only in a couple of years, and he said he spent most of it in the brig, but I'm sure that's not the case.
And, you know, if your first words were the Marine Corps hymn, I'm sure your father at some point told you something about his life in the Marine Corps. Do you remember hearing stories about what he did as a young Marine in World War II or anything?
Well, yeah. Being an only child and living on Marine bases until I actually went off to college, I mean, I just lived the life. So I remember him. He was gone about seven years during my growing up years from the time when I was born, he was overseas in World War II. The first time he saw me, he said I was walking and talking. And then he was gone in Korea for about 2 years, and then he was in Okinawa for a year and a half. And then he got stationed when I was a senior in high school in Adak, Alaska, which was an unaccompanied tour. So, but other than that, I'm the only child. He went in the Marine Corps as enlisted, and eventually, so it was a Mustang, and eventually went to Officers Candidate School in 1944. And during his enlisted years, he was a drill instructor in San Diego. So I jokingly say that the personality flaws I have come from the fact that I'm the only child of a Marine Corps drill instructor.
Yeah, and you can leave the rest to everybody's imagination there, I'm sure, and they'll fill in the blanks. But in all seriousness, what do you look back on and see in your father's example that has had an influence on you and your life?
Well, dedication to the United States of America, first of all. And all the military services are the same. They have different missions, but they're all basically the same. They're all service-oriented towards the United States. And so there's a tremendous amount of patriotism. My father instilled in me that, of course, I was in high school and college during the draft years. So you had choices. You could either be drafted, or you could volunteer to go in the military, or you could serve in other ways like the Peace Corps or some other ways. But in one way or another, you needed to give back to your country that serves you so well. You needed to serve them in some fashion. And because the only thing I knew was the Marine Corps, the only thing I'd ever experienced was the Marine Corps, it was just sort of a logical choice that I would go into the Marine Corps. And I actually went in through the NRTC program. I didn't want to go to the I had the opportunity to go to the Naval Academy, but I didn't want to go because, one, everybody came out as an engineer, and two, there were no women in the Naval Academy back in those days. So I chose an easier path. I went through the NRTC program at a public university where I could enjoy some freedom and females and a regular college life and pick a major that was whatever my choosing was. But at the end of the day, the same day I graduated, I was commissioned as second lieutenant in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, and you know, Annapolis has a little ocean and Chesapeake Bay nearby. University of Idaho in Moscow doesn't have the same kind of beachfront property. But sounds like there are some other priorities there that made that attractive to you.
Yeah, it was a great place. It back in the 60s, very conservative school, even the turbulent 60s, very conservative school. Bunch of farm boys. I was kind of an anomaly coming from San Diego County up there. But I was a swimmer there, and 100% of the swim team was from California. So I had some friends that I could relate to. And it was a little bit of a culture shock when the snow started to fall in the first year I was there, but eventually it was a wonderful place to go to college.
Well, and you alluded to the turbulent 60s, and that was one of my questions. You know, to be a future Marine Corps officer on campus, was there an element of that where you faced opposition or you saw protests or, you know, things that made you question that future for yourself?
No, there were all three branches of the service. Of course, the Marine Corps is a part of the Department of the Navy. So, but there was a very strong Army ROTC, Air Force ROTC, and Naval ROTC with the Marine Corps option after your sophomore year. And they were people who were in those programs were very much esteemed. You wore your uniforms on campus on Fridays. You were very much respected for wearing those uniforms and being in those ROTC programs.
So you said, you know, upon graduation, you're commissioned a second lieutenant. How long was it after that that you were headed to Vietnam?
6 months. Every Marine Corps officer at the time, whether regardless of your ultimate MOS, whether you were going to be a pilot or an artillery officer or an engineer or a tanker or an infantry officer, every Marine Corps officer went through the exact same training in Quantico, Virginia to become a rifle platoon commander. Probably 10 or 15% actually became rifle platoon commanders. The rest went into other specialties because there are so many different MOSs in the Marine Corps. But you all went through the same training. So every Marine Corps officer is a rifleman. Every Marine Corps person is a rifleman, period, whether you're a cook or a tanker or an infantry person. I chose infantry. That was my, that's what I wanted to do. That's what my father was, and that's what I knew. And that's really the core. The rest of the MOSs surround the infantry in the Marine Corps, and so that was what I was geared to do. That's what I was probably trained to do from my growing up years. So I knew that was what I was going to do. And so 6 months later, after I graduated in June, and on January 4th, 1968, I found myself in Vietnam.
And if I'm remembering correctly, your father is still in the Marines at this point, right?
He had just retired.
Do you remember any particular advice or encouragement that he shared with you as you started this Marine Corps journey here? He's been a veteran of World War II and the Korean War, and you're about to see combat in Vietnam.
Well, he just had, he knew me well, and he knew that I had picked the right specialty in the Marine Corps, but he prepared me. I think he started preparing me probably when I was in high school, even freshman or so in high school, before there we knew there was a Vietnam. There was no Vietnam. Even when I went to college in 1963, I'd never heard of it, didn't know there was anything going on in Vietnam. It wasn't until about 1965 that suddenly it became apparent that there was a conflict in Southeast Asia that we might be involved in. So at that point in time, he was still in the military. He was at headquarters Marine Corps. He began to prepare me for what it would be like to go to war. There are peacetime Marines and wartime Marines, and so he began to prepare me. And so I carried that with me, and so when I got there, I was probably much better prepared than a lot of people who didn't have the life that I'd had.
Is there a particular concept or perspective or example of that preparation that you look back on and say, yeah, that was really crucial or helpful, or that separated or distinguished me from others?
Well, he taught me, I think, very clearly that, son, he said, there are times in combat where you can do everything right and everything will go wrong, and troops under your command will die, and you just need to expect that and be prepared for that.
Somebody like me hears that and says, what could possibly prepare you for something like that?
Well, you just need to understand that that's just war. I mean, war is chaos. War does not go according to the plan. I mean, you make all the best laid plans. He was a tremendous planner. He would say, son, you need to have plan A, plan B, and plan C, and then be prepared for none of those to work, and how are you going to react to it?
And I'm inferring from those comments that you faced some scenarios that brought those words to mind. Are there some examples you can share with us, things you experienced over there that stand out in your memories?
Well, there are a lot of them, actually. I was with a rifle company the entire 13 months that I was there. So I was a rifle platoon commander for a long period of time. And then about 9 months into it, I became a company executive officer and then eventually a company commander. So I was basically in the jungle along the DMZ with the 3rd Marine Division, just fighting the ground war. But after I was there for 2 weeks, we were in a major base called Fubai, and it was kind of down in the rice paddy area, and that's where I picked up my platoon on January 4th, and it seemed kind of quiet. And we ran ambushes at night and patrols during the day, and nothing ever seemed to happen, and I thought this was pretty easy duty. It was kind of like a walk in the sun. Then they loaded us on C-130s and told us they were taking us to a fire support base up on the DMZ called Khon Tien. And when we got up in the air, the plane turned suddenly sharp 90-degree left, which to me meant west. And they told us where they were taking us to a place called Khe Sanh, which ended up being a rather famous siege combat base during the early part of the first Tet Offensive of January 1968. And lasted through about April 1968. And so I was on a hill position 5,000 meters outside the wire, protecting the combat base with a couple of other rifle companies. And eventually they let us, we just sat there and took a pounding. We were supposedly surrounded by 30, 40, 50,000 NVA. Nobody knew for sure, on hillsides on three sides of us, which was not a good place to be. And eventually they let us out of the wire in April 6th and 7th of 1968. And we were the first company-sized patrol that ever went out of the wire anywhere around. There were about 5,000 Marines on all the hill positions in the main base. And as the first company-sized combat patrol, it was obviously we were going out to search and destroy. And we went up 2,000 or 3,000 meters outside the wire, up one of the ridge lines that was surrounding us, and we ran into the enemy. And that day, the first day, my platoon was in reserve. We lost probably half the people in the 1st and 3rd platoon. The second day, we went back up. My platoon was in the lead, and we went up with 43 men in my platoon, and only 7 walked off, and I was not one of them. Only 7 went back that night. The rest were all medevaced. That was my first real experience at hand-to-hand, being close enough to be able to, you know, shoot at people eye-to-eye, throw hand grenades at each other. And while I was in the landing zone waiting to be medevaced back to Da Nang, I had one of my sergeants die in my arms, and he kept looking at me saying, "Help me, Lieutenant, help me, help me." And I knew from the wounds that he had suffered that there was nothing I could do but just to hold on to him.
And you're a Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. I can feel, I don't know if stoicism is the right word, but you're in control of your emotions as you describe these intense experiences very matter-of-factly. But as you share that story of holding that Marine in your arms, I get the sense that when you talk about that, you see that again, you feel that again, you're there again.
Yeah, I've told that story probably 50 times, and I choke up every time.
You remember his name?
Staff Sergeant
Herman Lohman.
And he'd been in your platoon for a while?
He was my right guide, and that's like you have a platoon leader who's a lieutenant, and you have a platoon sergeant, and then you have a right guide, so he was like the number 3 guy.
So, I mean, even somebody listening who's never been in the military, they can think of the people they spend time with, their friends, their, you know, the ones they go out to dinner with or play golf with or whatever. I mean, this is somebody that you're spending that kind of time with on a daily basis, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So most of us have not been in that situation that you're describing. Can you help us understand what that feels like, what that's really like in a moment like that? And if I'm not mistaken, while you're holding him in your arms, knowing that he's not going to make it, you're wounded yourself too, right?
Yeah. But not near as seriously as a lot of the other people were in the LZ. And, you know, the thing that I talk about is that it takes me back to what my father said. You can do everything right and everything goes wrong. And I did everything right. And it just part of, we went out looking for them. And we found them, and they found us, and it was just a dogfight.
What do you feel? What do you think? What do you focus on in a moment like that? Your friend is in your arms, and you know he's not going to make it.
I don't know. I think you're just kind of numb, but I describe that. You ask about a significant incident because that was the first experience. I had been there about 3 months, and that was the first experience where I physically, we were in a firefight, and I physically lost people. He wasn't the only one. There were a lot of others, too, that died that day, but he was just one that I physically watched him die in my arms. But it prepared me for the next 9 months that was left, or 9 or 10 months that was left on my tour. So it was the first time, but it certainly wasn't the last time. So it just prepares you. You just get steeled to the fact that this is what you do, and this is just going to happen, and you just have to move on. It's your job.
It's time for our first break, but there is much more to come with Purple Heart Marine Bob Nguyen of Monterey, California. More about his experience in Vietnam, plus what he's doing today to help veterans and their families trying to cope with PTSD. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for a video with Bob, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with decorated Marine Corps veteran Bob Nguyen of Monterey, California, where Hometown Heroes has aired every weekend for many years now on affiliate KION. The son of a World War II Marine, Bob saw intense combat as a Marine in Vietnam. He told us of the firefight that left him wounded and holding a dying Marine named Herman Lohman in his arms. Staff Sergeant Herman Lohman's name is one of more than 58,000 names etched on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. And Bob knows his name could have very easily ended up there as well.
And what were the extent of your injuries? What happened to you that day?
Well, the other thing was that my radio man was as close to me as you are to me now, which is about 2 feet. And he took 3 machine gun rounds and a hand grenade. And all I got was one. I was just shot once in the leg. So they opened up on the two of us. I had laid the platoon down, and we were up looking, trying to creep up ahead of the platoon just a little bit to see if we could get to the top of the ridge line, and they were waiting for us in spider traps at the top. A spider trap opened up, and a hand grenade came out, like the old World War II potato masher, you know, with the tin can on a stick, came flying out. And I saw it coming, and at the exact same time, machine gun opened up on the two of us, and I went right, and he went left. I went into a B-52 crater, and he went into a fighting hole, I guess, because and then I was able to get back to my platoon, and they found him 2 or 3 hours later. Another rifle company came down the ridge line and found him. And I show an interesting clip in the video that I use for my talk. I show an interesting clip of him describing that situation. I found it in the New York State Military Museum, and it's him describing that day and that situation. So he got shot up very badly and eventually sent back to the United States, and all I got was a leg wound. I was sent down to Da Nang for a couple of weeks and then rejoined my unit.
And you told us that that prepared you for the rest of what you were going to see. But at that moment, you don't know the rest of what you're going to see. And you don't know when you're going to be back with your unit or anything like that. So when you did go back, how different was your perspective or your outlook or just your mentality?
Well, it just brings to life what you'd all been taught and trained, that war is chaotic and bad things are going to happen, and you just need to do the best you can with your training. You've been trained extremely well, but that does not necessarily dictate the outcome of firefights when you're shooting at each other from 15 or 20 feet. You don't have a lot of control at that point.
Well, and you know, you said that was the first, but it was definitely not the last. And, you know, I don't ask out of morbid curiosity or, you know, trying to get gratuitous stories out of you, but I'm sure there are some other incidents that when you reflect on that time are still intense memories for you. Is there anything else you care to share? Things that you saw, did, or witnessed?
Well, about halfway through the tour, 13-month tour in the Marine Corps, about halfway through the tour, we went on to the 2nd Battalion, 26th Marines, was assigned to the 3rd Marine Division as his battalion landing team, which meant that we were supported by a squadron of helicopters, and supposedly we were supposed to be based off ships off in the China Sea. But in the 7 months left on my tour, we only saw the ships three times for about 48 hours each time. And so that battalion landing team was used by the 3rd Marine Division commander to basically pick us up and put a battalion, and my company, the Golf Company, was the company I was with most of the time, into places that had not been occupied for a while. And so that's a long way of saying that we were dropped into very inhospitable situations quite frequently. It turned out not to be the great shipboard duty going to the Philippines and Okinawa that we thought it was. It turned out to be pretty hostile time.
Yeah, most of us have never, will never experience something like this. So it sounds like you're getting dropped into scenarios that there's no way to prepare for. You have no idea what to expect. You just have to be ready to react to anything that happens.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, the helicopters would pick you up. Sometimes it was three times it was off a ship, which was exhilarating. You see those helicopters out there on an aircraft carrier with the rotors all, and you jump in these helicopters on heliteams, and they lift you off and take you into a jungle somewhere and drop you in the middle of nowhere. But most of the time, they just pick us up from one spot to another right where we were. And you never knew from one day to the next when the helicopters were coming to get you and when your job was over and where you were going next. You just got a new series of maps. We didn't have GPS or any of those things back in those days. Everything was maps and radio communications. And, you know, as a lieutenant I was a second lieutenant and a first lieutenant while I was there. I mean, you're the low man on the totem pole. You just go where they tell you to go and when they be ready to go. So yeah, it was unpredictable, to say the least.
Yeah, can you give us some examples of some of the things you encountered in those unpredictable situations?
Well, some turned out to be a walk in the sun where nobody had been in for a while and they wanted to send a unit in there to see if there was any, and we were primarily fighting the NVA. Everything was a free fire zone. There were really no villages, no civilian population that we had to be concerned with. If bushes moved, you could shoot and ask questions later. So a number of the places that we went, it turned out to be nobody there and nothing to shoot at and nobody shooting at you. And other places, from the time the helicopters started into the landing zone, you were taking bullets through the fuselage of the helicopters, and you knew that it was going to be pretty chaotic. It was all pretty much in the mountainous areas along the DMZ, Kantian, Quezon, Camp Carroll. So it wasn't down in the rice paddy areas, and so a lot of the problems were line of sight. You really couldn't see very far, so you really never knew exactly what you were getting into. But I would say that there were probably 15 or 20 situations that where we went into hot landing zones. Sometimes you were the first unit in, first platoon in, sometimes you were the third platoon in, and you knew what you were getting into. If the radio calls came back that it was a hot LZ, if it was not, why, it was just kind of a 2 or 3 days walking around looking for somebody, and if they weren't there, they picked you up and took you someplace else.
I don't think a lot of people are envying that lieutenant in Vietnam as we're talking about it. And you talked about, you know, being prepared, and you felt very prepared, and then that first real close call prepared you for the rest. But I have to ask an obvious and maybe dumb question. Did you ever think you might not make it home? Did you ever feel that fear or terror that hey, I'm not getting out of this?
I figured I probably wouldn't make it home. The lifespan of a second lieutenant making helicopter assaults into the jungle areas, they were not good. And as a result of that, I didn't know exactly where I was going to be when I got there. It's just the unit I got assigned to. But my wife and I had been high school sweethearts. We'd gone to different colleges. We'd been apart for 5 or 6 years. And then when I got commissioned and graduated from college, she wanted to get married. And I said, you know, I'm an infantry officer. I'm going right to Vietnam. And I would suggest that we not get married. Let's just wait until I get back. And if I'm still the person that you want to marry, then fine, we'll do that. And because the life expectancy of a person doing what I was doing, either living through it or coming back with all your arms and legs and, you know, fully capable of functioning, was not very good. And so I just went in with that mentality. As luck would have it, or as God would have it, because God was in control, we were married 10 days after I got back. And so it did work out.
Yeah, and I hear in you sharing that there was, I don't know that I would call it a resignation, but definitely a view of reality, that this is the likely scenario, or these are what the odds say. But I also hear what I think is a confidence that you carried with you, or a strength to endure those situations. I mean, you said 15 or 20 hot landing zones that you got thrown into. What do you think it was that helped you handle those situations that, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know if I could handle. I think a lot of people wouldn't have confidence they could handle. What was it that propelled or carried you?
Well, I don't mean this to sound boastful at all, but I was really good at what I did. In fact, I have said many, many times over through my second career, which was a business career, that I was never as good at anything in my work life as I was at that job. I mean, that's just what I was kind of raised to do, and that's what I was really good at. I wasn't confident. I mean, I knew that I knew what I was doing. I knew I was good at it, and I knew my troops would follow me. But it was just fate that allowed me to come home, because I can name the incident I just described where my radio man got all shot up and I only got one minor leg wound. And there were multiple situations like that where, I mean, I just barely missed a bullet by just inches, and I can't explain it.
And were there other occasions where you were wounded, or just that first time?
No, that was the only time.
And what do you do with that if you've had so many close calls that you lose count? Does that have an impact on how you live the next day or the next year or the next decade of your life?
Well, yeah, I've become very fatalistic. Pretty soon you begin to think, well, it's my time. If it's my time, it's my time. And God will know that. He's in control of that. I'm not. And I've had a number of kind of unusual circumstances over the last 30 or 40 years where I was supposed to be on an airplane, and I changed my flight reservations at the last minute, and the airplane crashed, and everybody was killed. And I was not on it. But the friend that I was on a business trip with was on it. He took the flight. I changed it. And so that's just one of those fatalistic things. If it's your time, it's your time. And there are things you control and some things you don't. And in combat, you don't control everything.
And I don't want to leave out anything else from your time there that you think is important. So feel free to insert that. But, you know, you mentioned getting married very soon after you came home. Do you remember what it was like to leave Vietnam, to come back to the States? Was that cause for celebration? Did you have mixed feelings? What was that like?
No, I was really excited. I mean, we used to call it going back to the world, because back in those days, you were totally disconnected from the world. Half of the letters that my fiance would write to me, I would get. She would get just half of mine. We had no radio contact. The only time I saw her, my parents were in Hawaii. So I went at 11 months, I went to Hawaii on R&R. She flew over there, and my fiance flew over there and stayed with them until I arrived. And so we were able to plan the wedding. And then I had to go back for 60 more days. And so I was walking on eggs those next 60 days, because we had planned, she was planning the wedding. I was just trying to figure out who was going to be my groomsman and in the wedding. But when I came back, fortunately, I've never suffered from PTSD, and that's why I have started giving this talk about PTSD, because I never experienced it, but so many people did, and I've had a lot of people ask me why, and I would tell them just because I think I was well prepared for the experience that I was going to go through, and a lot of people just aren't. So when I got back, I actually ended up going into the unit that I was scheduled to go to when I first graduated from the basic school, and that was a force recon unit, which is kind of the Navy SEALs of the Marine Corps, if you want to call it that. And so life was good. I mean, I was doing all the fun things that you do in that unit, a very small specialized unit, doing all the and nobody was shooting at me. And we were in Camp Pendleton, which is on the coast of Southern California. I was married. 10 months later, she got pregnant. And so I just kind of put it behind me, moved on. Life was good.
And you made reference to a talk that you give, and that the fact that you didn't suffer from PTSD is why you're doing something to try to help those who are. What's the origin of that? And maybe you can give us a nutshell version of what that talk consists of.
I always knew about PTSD, but, you know, I kind of had the attitude, unfortunately, and I regret it now, but I had the attitude like, look, we all went through the same experiences in Vietnam. You came back to the world. You're safe. Maybe you have some physical or problems, but mentally, you know, you made it. Get over it. Move on. I mean, life, people did that in all the wars before us, right? Just move on. And if you stay in the service, fine. If you don't, get out and make your career whatever it's going to be and make your family life whatever it's going to be, and don't live in the past of that traumatized 12 or 13 months that we all went through. And later, probably about 7 or 8 years ago, I was asked by a friend of my son-in-law's up in Seattle. I came across the street and asked me if I had ever read the book Matterhorn, which was written by an individual that had served as a Marine Corps rifle platoon commander in Vietnam just about 6 months after me. I mean, he got there about 6 months after, so we overlapped. And I said, no, I really never have. He said, well, it's a fictional book written about a Marine Corps rifle platoon commander in Vietnam. I would be interested in you reading that book. And then when you next come up and visit your daughter and son-in-law in Seattle, I'd like to know what you think of it. How realistic is it? Because it seems like to me, him never having been in the military, it's very realistic. So I did. I read it. And it turns out the guy who wrote it, it was a New York Times bestseller. I had never heard of it, but I didn't read a lot of military stuff anyway, so I'm not surprised. But it was a New York Times bestseller written by a fellow who ended up living about 20 minutes away from my kids in Seattle. And so I read the book, and I figured maybe I could find this guy because we were in a lot of the same places. He mentions a lot of the same fire bases and things that I was at. The Matterhorn is a fictional place, but all the surrounding places in the cover of the book are real life places. So I went on a search for him, eventually found him, and he returned my call, and we've since become really good friends. We agreed to have lunch. When we had lunch, he asked if I had read his second book called What It's Like to Go to War. I said I hadn't. He said, well, I'd be interested in you reading that book. He said it's a lot easier to read and a lot shorter. And it's a book that he had written about what it is like to be in intense combat, the kind of combat where you're in firefights shooting at one another from 15 or 20 feet, that kind of combat. Not in a combat zone necessarily on a big base, but actually in really close combat. And so I read the book and then went back and had lunch with him, and turns out he'd suffered dramatically from PTSD when he came back. Multiple Purple Hearts, Navy Cross winner, highly celebrated, decorated Marine lieutenant. Went to Yale, got a Rhodes Scholarship, dropped out of Oxford to join the Marine Corps and go to Vietnam. So he's quite an accomplished guy. But so as we got talking over several lunches over the next year, he had testified before Congress about PTSD and veterans benefits for PTSD and recognizing it. And I guess I got the guilt complex that I had never really taken up the cause, even though I'd been in the same experiences that he had. I'd never suffered from it, so I'd never taken up the cause. And it just sort of got me thinking that I'm retired, I have the time, this is a way that I can give back, because so many people, some from Vietnam, obviously, but we're getting to be the older generation now, but so many in the recent wars, starting in the 90 wars, the Gulf Wars, through the withdrawal from Afghanistan and Iraq, which is almost 20 or 30 years of war, are suffering from PTSD for a lot of different reasons. Those wars are so much different than the one that we experienced. Multiple deployments, constant communication with your family back home on computers and cell phones, and multiple tours, and yet similar in ways that they're wars you're not necessarily going to win. We pulled out of most of those wars without winning them, and most of those places we were left in chaos, and it leaves these people without arms and legs and with nightmares. And while I'm not medically prepared to deal with them, I am able to explain to their wives and fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters why they are the way they are. And so that's the crux of what I try to do, is explain to people why their sons and daughters, and now it's daughters just as much as it is sons and daughters, come back so traumatized by the experiences of war.
It's time for our final break. The author that Bob was referring to, as you may have figured out, is Carl Marlantis. I have links to his books about Vietnam for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But there's more to come with this Marine Corps veteran, Bob Nguyen, including the life-saving gift he was able to share with another Marine, his World War II veteran father. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car, and here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Marine Corps veteran Bob Nguyen of Monterey, California. We heard about how you earned the Purple Heart, Bob, but are there any other decorations you think we should know about?
Well, there was a Presidential Unit Citation, which was awarded for the combat base at Quezon, which is pretty famous. The entire 26th Marine Regiment got that. And the Vietnam Cross of Gallantry was just awarded for a couple of specific things that we did that probably I shouldn't be talking about because they were not necessarily known in the press at the time.
Boy, does that put all kinds of questions in our minds. But we respect you can't talk about that. You told us you have been giving talks about PTSD and how families can support their loved ones who may be battling that. What kind of groups are you giving these presentations to?
Any place that's provides a venue. I mean, I have a lot of retirement places, Rotaries, Kiwanis, this group that we're at today, I was here. And the flavor of the talk changes based on the amount of military people that are in the room. I'm going to be giving this talk, interestingly enough, next spring to the Marine Corps class that I graduated with in November of 1967. We have reunions. And I'm going to be giving the talk back there on the East Coast to this reunion group, most of whom went to Vietnam because we all graduated in 67 and we got there in 68 or 69, depending on whether we were pilots or artillerymen or infantrymen. And the flavor of the talk will be different for them. For them, I will be trying to convince them to do what I do, to identify themselves as somebody who's been in a combat zone, been in a war, and if you wear gear, whether it's a hat or a shirt or a jacket or something that identifies you, you'd be surprised. It's like a magnet for people to come up, and I've had people come up to me and now that will talk to me when they wouldn't talk to anybody else because they understand that I understand. So it will be different for them. If it's a group that not a lot of people have a lot of exposure to the military, have never been in the military, then it's more trying to explain what it's like to be in a firefight.
If there's somebody listening to this who says, boy, I'd love to hear this talk. This is really relevant for my group or my situation. What should they do?
I've never had it videoed, and I don't have a website. It's just word of mouth at this point. But I'd be more than willing to travel a distance to it. Of course, I live in Monterey, California. But I'd be more than willing to travel, and it's sort of my way to give back. So I'm sure they can maybe contact you, and I can give you my information.
Well, you're talking about giving back, and I think everybody listening can hear your heart for those who've been damaged by war in different ways. But that's not the only way you've given back. I learned something about you today. It's not something I talk about much, but I had the privilege of sharing one of my kidneys 5 years ago, and you're a kidney donor yourself. You gave your kidney to a pretty special guy, didn't you?
Yeah, I did have the privilege when I was age 59 and my dad was 83, to my career Marine Corps dad, to donate my kidney to him, which gave him 7 years of life beyond that. Pretty special to be able to save your parents' life.
That's the very straightforward version of the story, but I'm sure there's a few things that you learned or you experienced as a result of that you couldn't have anticipated when you offered your kidney to him.
Well, one of them is neither of my parents were churchgoers. To the best of my knowledge, they were not Christians, even though they knew that my wife and I were very strong Christians and had raised our family that way. And just before they wheeled us into two different operating rooms, one to take out my kidney and a second to put him in an operating room to be the recipient, we were laying in the bed side by side. And he held out his hand and asked me to pray for him. And we had 7 more years of that kind of a relationship.
And one of the reasons I think more people don't decide to become living kidney donors is they fear that there may be some negative effects for them or their future. And I think you've done a few things athletically since becoming a kidney donor that may fly in the face of that. How many triathlons have you completed?
I've always been a good athlete, a high school and college athlete. So my daughter was also a very high-level college athlete, and she convinced me that at age 62, I could do triathlons, which she had gotten into in her early 30s, I guess, and that we had the same skills, running and swimming. And she said, Dad, everybody knows how to ride a bike, so I bought a bike, and together we did about 20 triathlons together, and we've done half a dozen open water swims from Alcatraz to San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, across Lake Washington, across Lake Tahoe, across San Diego Bay, and then we've done about a half a dozen 100-mile bike rides, one-day bike rides.
All after you donated your kidney?
Yeah. I donated it when I was 59. I started doing that at age 62.
Got to ask you, all that open water swimming, you know, there's a reason people are afraid to open water swim. Even around here in the Monterey Bay, they're worried about sharks. Any shark encounters in all those swims?
No. My goal was always not to be in the front and not to be dead last, be somewhere in the pack. And if you're in the pack, your chances are probably, you know, 1 in 200 or 300 of being picked out.
Well, I guess I have to ask, too, is there anything else you're not telling us that some noteworthy things that you've done? Because you seem to have a lot of surprises in your story here.
No, not really. My life hasn't been noteworthy in any regard. It's just the way I was raised and the way I've tried to live my life. And I married the right lady. We've got 2 wonderful kids and 5 great-grandkids. And we, now that I'm retired, we spend a lot of time with them.
Well, some of the people listening might disagree on the noteworthy part. I do want to ask you one more question about this presentation you give with regard to PTSD. Is there one kind of overarching message that you hope people receive? You said you tailor your talk a little different for a different audience, but is there one kind of central message you're hoping to communicate?
Yeah, just because somebody is suffering from PTSD does not mean there's anything wrong with them. It's not a deficiency. It's not an inferiority thing in their makeup. The guy that I described that first got me into this, who's written these books, is one of the least likely people you would ever expect to suffer from it. And I've encountered other people that were extremely strong, successful people that you would never imagine, and come to find out when they find out about your experiences and what you've been through, they will open up to you, and you would never suspect that they suffered from PTSD. So you should not, as I did, think, you know, get over it, move on, put it behind you. You should never think that of people. It's inexplainable necessarily who it affects or how bad the symptoms can be.
So it sounds like, you know, a lot of people are out there trying to provide hope for those who suffer from PTSD, but it sounds like you're focused more on the rest of us to help us have more patience, compassion, understanding for those who battle PTSD.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do, because of that, run into people who suffer from PTSD, and I explain to them right off the bat that I'm not medically trained necessarily to deal with them, but there are a lot of people that are. But one particular incident was an individual whose wife wrote a letter to our pastor at church, and he referred it to me. And in her letter, she said that her husband had multiple deployments as an Army sergeant to Iraq and Afghanistan, and he'd had problems with drug and alcohol, and now they had a young daughter. He was trying to be a better father, but he wouldn't talk to anybody. And was there a way that the pastor could counsel him? And the pastor tossed it off to me, and so I agreed to meet with them after church one Sunday, and I use this example in my talk. I agreed to meet with them after church, but his wife did call us and say, now be prepared for the fact that my husband will not, he does not talk. I mean, he might just sit there and stare for an hour. He might not say anything. And I said, well, that's fine. So we met after church. I didn't know this couple, a younger couple. Obviously, we met after church. We went into a small room off the side of the sanctuary, and I just kind of introduced my wife and I and told him a little bit about my experiences in the Marine Corps and in Vietnam. His eyes kind of opened up, and he didn't stop talking for an hour and a half. And his wife just kept looking at us like, who is this guy? And it was just, it gave me the sense that even though I wasn't medically capable of dealing with his issues, he understood that I understood, and so he would talk to me, and that was a start.
And I'm sure that's touching some heartstrings for a lot of people out there. If there's anything else that you think we need to know, feel free to share, but I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for serving your fellow veterans. Thank you for the inspirational example you're providing for us. I know you've got a lot that you're looking forward to, and you're dedicated to continuing to serve in this way, but if you look back, if you look in the rearview mirror, is there something that you would say at age 77 you're most proud of or you're most satisfied with?
My family. You know, my family came along. Obviously, we got married after I got back. My wife was pregnant with our first daughter 10 months after we were married, so they're now 50 and 52 years old, I guess, and they're both married, have very strong marriages, and five grandchildren who are all great kids in their own right. So, yeah, I mean, you go through something when you're 21. I was 21, 22 years old when I was in Vietnam, pretty young guy, but that does not necessarily, that experience should not necessarily define you. So, yeah, I'm most proud of the fact that I've been married for 53 years to the same lady, and our kids have been married 25 and 27 years, respectively, to the same guys, and so that's what I'm most proud of.
And we are proud to know you, Marine Corps veteran Bob Nguyen of Monterey, California. If you would like to connect with Bob and have him deliver his PTSD presentation to a group in your area, go to hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a short video with some of Bob's Marine Corps memories. That's all the time we have on the radio today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.